episode. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 324, just hanging. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, guten Morgen, because here I am recording in the morning, which I almost never do, but today was one of those days, and last night was one of those nights, and so here I am. And I have just a couple abyssal things to share with you before we get to the Age of Innocence. The first is some medical community here in the United States put out a calculator, which then got roundly dissed by people for saying, oh no, it's way inflating the risks and blah, blah, blah. It's a calculator for figuring out what your risks for heart disease are based on your gender, your age, your race, your total cholesterol, your HDL cholesterol, that's the good cholesterol, not the lousy cholesterol, systolic blood pressure, and then whether you are in treatment for high blood pressure, diabetes, or whether you are a smoker. Now, if you're outside of the United States, I don't know if this is as big a deal. With our diet here, it kind of is. And I have historically very low blood pressure, but high cholesterol. And my ratio is excellent and always has been. So even though my total number is very high, I've been told that my risk factor of arteriosclerosis or bad things like that is actually quite low. So I thought, you know, they're saying that this calculator is lousy, but I'm curious and I want to see how I measure up because I'm pretty aware of what my risk factors are. So I went ahead and downloaded this thing. It's just an Excel spreadsheet, but it's one of those things where you plug in your factors and then it does a little graph calculation for you and shows you. And I actually think, as far as my risk factors and what I know is concerned, that this is actually pretty darn accurate. And that over the course of a lifetime, my lifetime risk is actually probably pretty high, just because of the total cholesterol in my bloodstream. But all things considered, my 10-year risk factor is ridiculously low. It's like a 0.5%, which seems right to me, being 46. Between now and the time that I turn 56, I'm probably going to be just fine. But after that, I'm probably going to have to do something. And so I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes, because if you're at all curious, I figure it's best to be over-informed and maybe even have your risk factor over-identified, just so that you pay attention. And that's not always a bad thing. So I'm putting the link to that on the show notes. I also have two other links that I'm going to give you. The first is a link to a book at Amazon called The International Bank of Bob. This is a guy who made a fortune and started realizing that he could do a lot with his money by making microloans. And he was involved in the starting of the Kiva loan program. This is an online loan program. You can send money directly to people all over the world who are in developing countries who are in need of cash financing. The amazing thing is that these loans have something ridiculous like a 99.9% payback rate, right? And then you can take that money and reinvest it. So a $25 loan can help somebody start their own business, and then they will make enough money that they pay you back and you can pay it forward and help somebody else. A friend of mine turned me on to this. She's been making these microloans all year long. And I thought, boy, I don't have a lot of money to throw away, but this doesn't feel like charity to me. This sounds like smart investing, because I know from the UN and the different programs that my parents have been involved in, and these interesting international folks who I get to meet because of my parents and their cool jobs, I have learned that in Africa, in Asia, all over the world, when there are, sorry guys, but particularly women who are entrepreneurial and who get these microloans, that the standard of living for their family goes up at, what is it, a geometric rate? It's a ridiculous rate. And their kids are healthier, their kids are better fed, their kids are doing better in school, and a rising tide lifts all ships. So I wanted to give you a link to the book that the guy wrote, and also a link to the Kiva Loan program. It looks like once I finished the sign-up process, it looks like I'll have the opportunity to invite people, and then you get like a $25 credit or something for joining. I can't tell exactly what the details are because I'm still early in the process of signing up. But if you're interested, let me know. And by that time, I should have more information for you. And the last thing I wanted to share with you, even though I know you're not all knitters, there is a crafty blogger named Beverly, who goes by the awesome online name Pomo Go Lightly, which I love. And she's putting out a call to fight against Black Friday consumerism. I don't know about you, but I will run the opposite direction from any store on Black Friday. I have no interest in participating in the melee, and it just kind of makes me ill. So if you are like me in that, you will want to read her blog post, which I am linking to from the show notes. She is declaring Black Friday Craft Friday. And there will be lots more information coming out on her blog. But if you're interested, please, please, please check that out. So on the crafty side of things, I've been doing these Zentangle mugs. You may recall that Nanette the Nanny did an amazing sugar bowl, which I posted pictures of a few months ago. I've been doing mugs, thusly, and I've been posting about them on Mama O Knits. And every time I do, people are like, oh my gosh, how did you do that? I have now posted a link on the Mama O Knits site. I am linking to it from the show notes. If you are interested in finding out how to do these Zentangled mugs, or just decorate mugs in a permanent fashion for gifts, you can follow these instructions. There's another tutorial that I thought you might be interested in. Brenda Castile Designs. She has a newsletter, and I get it, and I was reading it today. She has a really interesting link to a very interesting tutorial for how to not ever, 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 for the rest of your life, twist a cast on. And the nice thing is, the woman who's doing this tutorial talks about how to do it if you're doing crochet, as well as if you're doing a knitted cast on, which I thought was very nice. And I have linked to the video version. I've actually embedded the video version into the show notes for this episode so that you can see what I saw, thanks to Brenda. So that was very cool. And the last thing, some of you know, because you were on Facebook or Twitter, some of you know that I was interviewed on the Fiber Hooligan podcast earlier this week. If you are interested, you can go to Blog Talk Radio and pull up Fiber Hooligan podcast, because anything that has the name Hooligan in it has to be good. And you will hear Benjamin Levesse, who is the head of XRX Publishing. He runs the Stitches Expos that happen 4 times a year. How he manages to pull off all he does. You think I'm busy. Nothing compared to that man. So he has this podcast, and he invited me on and interviewed me earlier this week. And I had a lovely time talking to him. He has a beautiful voice. Holy cow, you could totally listen to this guy read the phone book. And we had a very interesting kind of wide-ranging conversation where you learn some stuff about me. And if you've read or are planning to read Grounded, we talk a little bit about that, and you'll find out where some of my ideas from the book came from. And, you know, rack up points playing Trivial Pursuit if if my name ever comes up, because that's so bloody likely. But it was fun. We had a great time. And Tucker Walk Vineyards is the name of the winery that I allude to, but couldn't remember the name of when we were having our conversation. So there's that for you. The other thing that happened while I was on Fiber Hooligans was I got to see the actual numbers from the Halos of Hope podcaster throwdown. And we are having our derrieres served to us by Team Knit More Girls. So if you have any inclination towards knitting hats for people who are going through chemotherapy and radiation therapy and the stuff that makes you lose your hair, please consider knitting one or seven and putting them into the Halos of Hope podcaster throwdown Ravelry group page so that we can get our numbers up even a little bit. I think Knit More Girls, and hey, I mean, really, the name of their podcast is Knit More Girls, so obviously they're going to knit more than everybody else. Nonetheless, they're probably going to beat us roundly, but we don't have that far to go to come in second. We've got plenty of time, so consider tossing a hat in the ring. I know that Barocco no longer makes chinchilla yarn. However, I found that at my local store, Uniquities, they had a stash. And if you ask for it, they'll bring it out. So you might want to ask at your LYS to see if you can have any of their secret contraband brought out to you. So that was one. The second thing, don't forget we have the Fiona Ellis book for the giveaway this month. Please, please, please follow the link in the show notes for episode 324. The giveaway will end on November 30th. So you still have time. And the sale for novel socks and all of the socks that are related to the Grounded book. We'll have another one coming, going live next Tuesday. We started a sale last week saying that half of anything we sold, well, it's not a sale. It's that half of anything we sell will be going towards the Doctors Without Borders for their Philippine relief efforts. And that's been perking along quite nicely. So I've actually talked to Meg and I talked to Eleanor, and I'm extending that deal through the 30th of this month. So if you've been on the fence about getting the Novel Socks ebook or any of the individual patterns or anything from my personal Ravelry store or, and I'm just extending this, even copies of Grounded. As long as you buy them from my shop and not from Amazon, I will be able to send half of whatever I make to Doctors Without Borders. So that is another way that you can send some help to the poor people in the Philippines. And is it my imagination or did it already fall off of everybody's radar? I've heard like one little thing here, one little thing there. I heard that China is sending a floating hospital, which is like 1,400 beds, and it's amazing. I don't think it's left yet, though, but I'm sure that the people in the Philippines can use it when it gets there. So the giveaway and the donations to Doctors Without Borders for anything from my store, Ravelry store, or my online store, all of the links are in the show notes. That plus the giveaway will be continuing through November 30th this year, 2013. But now, on with the Age of Innocence. So, when last we left our intrepid pair, Newland and Ellen were heading off to have lunch together. They've reached their space. They have gotten a private room. They're sitting down to lunch. And now we finally have an opportunity to hear what they really have to say to each other. And, well, there's a lot to say after you've heard the conversation. It's not a very long chapter, but I think it's such an important one. It's kind of a pivotal one because we finally hear some of what's been going on in Ellen's mind anyway. And of course, Newland Archer is going to have his moment of extreme pathos where he will bare his soul somewhat anyway to Ellen. There's also some conversation about Washington, D.C., and I find it a kind of a curiosity, to be completely honest, because what Ellen says about Washington is what I've thought and what I've historically heard about New York. And I haven't heard this about Washington, D.C. quite so much. And in fact, I've often found that, was it Kennedy? You said Washington, D.C. is southern efficiency and northern charm. For those of you who are not in the United States, oh, I'm going to get in trouble for this one, aren't I? Northerners, Yankees, people in New York City and people in New England are not overly known for their effusive, charming interpersonal skills, which actually I have not found to be true. I have had a lovely time meeting and getting to know people in New York City, very brusque, very gruff people who are very proud of their city and very happy to show it off and who just don't want to waste time. And then the Southern efficiency part of that equation, I have equated, you can write in and correct me, but I have equated with the fact that during the Civil War, one of the reasons why the Northern anti-slavery coalition part of the country, the Union Army, finally at great length and over many, many years and many, many deaths was able to overwhelm the Southern armies was in large part due to the fact that the North was industrialized and very efficient, and the South was still very agricultural and very, I don't think this is the right word, but it fits, very colloquial. Business was done between people whose families had known each other for generations going back. And so there was no, there weren't any necessarily particularly efficient supply routes. And getting supplies to the armies, as you might imagine, was a huge endeavor. And the North had the railroads for the most part. And so that's where Kennedy's thing comes from. But keep that in mind when you hear Ellen talking about Washington, D.C., because it doesn't come across as the Northern charm and Southern efficiency that Kennedy talks about. So I'm going to have to look for a really interesting book on the history of Washington, D.C. I'm curious now, because this would have been right after the Civil War, 1870. It's 5 years after the Civil War. And, you know, where I am in Northern Virginia, it may be Northern Virginia, but it is still south of the Mason-Dixon line. And again, if you're not in the United States, the Mason-Dixon line was the line that cut the country in half, more or less, on a horizontal axis. So the states above the Mason-Dixon line were slave-free, and the states below the Mason-Dixon line were legal slave-owning states, which doesn't mean you were, by any stretch of the imagination, required to own slaves. It just means that that's where the slave trade was and where it was most broadly abused in that time. And I understand that if you see the movie 12 Years a Slave, which I have not seen yet, my understanding is that this, the peculiar institution of slavery is demonstrated in the film in visual and emotionally stunning, stupefying, horrifying ways, so that you really see how, as the man whose autobiography this movie was drawn from, as you see him getting sold further and further down the river, as it were, into the deep South, you see how the different levels of horror of slavery are perpetrated as he goes further and further into the interior of that economic way of life. And yeah, so if you're not familiar with how that part of American history worked, I think seeing that movie would be a real eye-opener. I'll tell you, though, I read so many slave narratives when I was teaching, and so much about that whole history, culminating for me with the movie Rosewood, which, if you've never seen, another excellent movie, a piece of history that was almost completely forgotten. And God bless, was it John Singleton, I think, who made the movie? Excellent film. Shocking, but excellent. Rosewood was kind of the final capstone on all of that research that I did. And I think I'm going to have to wait until the kids need to start seeing these movies, and then I'll start watching them again. Because it's hard. They're hard. They're really hard. But I understand 12 Years a Slave is excellent. So if you're interested, let me know what you thought. Okay, so that was a little Washington, D.C. digression. And now I think we should listen to the chapter, chapter 24 of The Age of Innocence, read to you by Brenda Dane.
Chapter 24. They lunched slowly and meditatively, with mute intervals between rushes of talk. For, the spell once broken, they had much to say, and yet moments when saying became the mere accompaniment to long duologues of silence. Archer kept the talk from his own affairs, not with conscious intention, but because he did not want to miss a word of her history. And leaning on the table, her chin resting on her clasped hands, she talked to him of the year and a half since they had met. She had grown tired of what people called society. New York was kind, it was almost oppressively hospitable. She should never forget the way in which it had welcomed her back. But after the first flush of novelty, she had found herself, as she phrased it, too different to care for the things it cared about. And so she had decided to try Washington, where one was supposed to meet more varieties of people and of opinion. And, on the whole, she should probably settle down in Washington and make a home there for poor Medora, who had worn out the patience of all her other relations just at the time when she most needed looking after and protecting from matrimonial perils. "But Dr. Carver, aren't you afraid of Dr. Carver? I hear he's been staying with you at the Blankers." She smiled. "Oh, the Carver danger is over. Dr. Carver is a very clever man. He wants a rich wife to finance his plans, and Medora is simply a good advertisement as a convert." "A convert to what?" "To all sorts of new and crazy social schemes. But do you know, they interest me more than the blind conformity to tradition, somebody else's tradition, that I see among our own friends. It seems stupid to have discovered America only to make it into a copy of another country." She smiled across the table. "Do you suppose Christopher Columbus would have taken all that trouble just to go to the opera with the Selfridge Marys?" Archer changed color. "And Beaufort? Do you say these things to Beaufort?" he asked abruptly. "I haven't seen him for a long while, but I used to, and he understands." "Oh, it's what I've always told you. You don't like us, and you like Beaufort because he's so unlike us." He looked about the bare room and out at the bare beach and the row of stark white village houses strung along the shore. "We're damnably dull. We've no character, no color, no variety. I wonder," he broke out, "why you don't go back." Her eyes darkened, and he expected an indignant rejoinder. But she sat silent, as if thinking over what he had said, and he grew frightened lest she should answer that she wondered too. At length she said, "I believe it's because of you." It was impossible to make the confession more dispassionately, or in a tone less encouraging to the vanity of the person addressed. Archer reddened to the temples, but dared not move or speak. It was as if her words had been some rare butterfly, that the least motion might drive off on startled wings, but that might gather a flock about it if it were left undisturbed. "At least," she continued, "it was you who made me understand that under the dullness there are things so fine and sensitive and delicate that even those I most cared for in my other life look cheap in comparison." "I don't know how to explain myself," she drew together her troubled brows, "but it seems as if I'd never before understood with how much that is hard and shabby and base the most exquisite pleasures may be paid for." "Exquisite pleasures? It's something to have had them," he felt like retorting, but the appeal in her eyes kept him silent. "I want," she went on, "to be perfectly honest with you and with myself. For a long time I've hoped this chance would come, that I might tell you how you've helped me, what you've made of me." Archer sat staring beneath frowning brows. He interrupted her with a laugh. "And what do you make out that you've made of me?" She paled a little. "Of you? Yes, I'm of your making much more than you ever were of mine. I'm the man who married one woman because another one told him to." Her paleness turned to a fugitive flush. "I thought you promised you were not to say such things today." "Ah, how like a woman. None of you will ever see a bad business through." She lowered her voice. "Is it a bad business for me?" He stood in the window, drumming against the raised sash, and feeling in every fiber the wistful tenderness with which she had spoken her cousin's name. "For that's the thing we've always got to think of, haven't we?" "By your own showing," she insisted. "My own showing," he echoed, his blank eyes still on the sea. "Or if not," she continued, pursuing her own thought with a painful application, "if it's not worthwhile to have given up, to have missed things so that others may be saved from disillusionment and misery, then everything I came home for, everything that made my other life seem, by contrast, so bare and so poor, because no one there took account of them, all these things are a sham or a dream." He turned around without moving from his place. "And in that case, there's no reason on earth why you shouldn't go back," he concluded for her. Her eyes were clinging to him desperately. "Oh, is there no reason? Not if you staked your all on the success of my marriage." She made no answer, and he went on. "What's the use? You gave me my first glimpse of a real life, and at the same moment, you asked me to go on with a sham one. It's beyond human enduring, that's all." "Oh, don't say that when I'm enduring it," she burst out, her eyes filling. Her arms had dropped along the table, and she sat with her face abandoned to his gaze, as if in the recklessness of a desperate peril. The face exposed her as much as if it had been her whole person, with a soul behind it. Archer stood dumb, overwhelmed by what it suddenly told him. "You too. Oh, all this time. You too." For answer, she let the tears on her lids overflow and run slowly downward. Half the width of the room was still between them, and neither made any show of moving. Archer was conscious of a curious indifference to her bodily presence. He would hardly have been aware of it if one of the hands she had flung out on the table had not drawn his gaze, as on the occasion when, in the little 23rd Street house, he had kept his eye on it in order not to look at her face. Now his imagination spun about the hand, as if about the edge of a vortex. But still, he made no effort to draw nearer. He had known the love that is fed on caresses and feeds them, but this passion that was closer than his bones was not to be superficially satisfied. His one terror was to do anything which might efface the sound and impression of her words, his one thought that he should never again feel quite alone. But after a moment, the sense of waste and ruin overcame him. There they were, close together and safe and shut in, yet so chained to their separate destinies that they might as well have been half the world apart. "What's the use? When will you go back?" he broke out, a great hopeless, "How on earth can I keep you?" crying out to her beneath his words. She sat motionless with lowered lids. "Oh, I shan't go yet." "Not yet. Sometime, then, sometime that you already foresee." At that she raised her clearest eyes. "I promise you, not as long as you hold out. Not as long as we can look straight at each other like this." He dropped into his chair. What her answer really said was, "If you lift a finger, you'll drive me back. Back to all the abominations you know of and all the temptations you half guess." He understood it as clearly as if she had uttered the words, and the thought kept him anchored to his side of a table, in a kind of moved and sacred submission. "What a life for you," he groaned. "Oh, as long as it's part of yours." "And mine a part of yours?" She nodded. "And that's to be all, for either of us." "Well, it is all, isn't it?" At that he sprang up, forgetting everything but the sweetness of her face. She rose too, not as if to meet him or to flee from him, but quietly, as though the worst of the task were done and she had only to wait. So quietly that as he came closer, her outstretched hands acted not as a check, but as a guide to him. They fell into his while her arms, extended but not rigid, kept him far enough off to let her surrendered face say the rest. They may have stood in that way for a long time, or only for a few moments, but it was long enough for her silence to communicate all she had to say, and for him to feel that only one thing mattered. He must do nothing to make this meeting their last. He must leave their future in her care, asking only that she should keep fast hold of it. Don't be unhappy," she said, with a break in her voice as she drew her hands away. And he answered, "You won't go back. You won't go back," as if it were one possibility he could not bear. "I won't go back," she said. And turning away, she opened the door and led the way into the public dining room. The strident school teachers were gathering up their possessions, preparatory to a straggling flight to the wharf. Across the beach lay the white steamboat at the pier, and over the sunlit waters, Boston loomed in a line of haze. End of chapter 24.
And so that's it. Nothing. Nothing. She won't go back as long as they can stay friends. And the only way they can stay friends is if they never do anything other than look at each other across a dinner table. And I think that this is the interesting question that Edith Wharton raises. And I think this goes directly to what some of the listeners have been saying about Edith Wharton's personal history, the affair that she had. She had a miserable marriage. She wound up having an affair herself with someone who was intellectually her and probably emotionally her equal. Someone who she, like Ellen and Newland, really got, really understood. They were on the same page. And I think at least for us here, this is the distinction between Newland and Lefferts, Lawrence Lefferts, or even Beaufort, that when given an opportunity where he and Ellen could have gone off and had a wild, rip-roaring affair in Boston, and, you know, it was easy to fool May, he got out of the house fine. Instead, this is where he and Ellen ended up. He's not Lefferts. He's going to be satisfied with this because this is at least better than knowing that Ellen has gone home to her abominable husband. But to me, this raises a different problem that I don't think Wharton really deals with in this book, and one that I think she couldn't have dealt with just herself, emotionally, personally, which is that even though Ellen and Newland never touch, this is it. I mean, we just saw how physically close they're going to get to each other. There is no question that the emotional drain of his love for Ellen on him is significant and pulls him away from May. He was fine with May. He was happy with May. It was great until Ellen showed up and he saw that different, that other. And maybe it would have happened with someone else. It didn't have to be Ellen. Maybe it would have been, you know, any woman who had opened his eyes. But that wedge that this relationship puts between Newland and May isn't something that can be discounted. And this is why, you know, people will say, you know, oh, well, it's only, I don't know, it's only an online relationship, or it's only somebody who I go out and get drinks with, or have lunches with, or I don't know, something like that. But you can tell that they are really emotionally in love with or invested in that other person. Never touch, never touch, never have done anything about it. But it is just as real, that kind of love, that kind of affection, and it can't be ignored. So next week we will see a little bit of the repercussions, a little bit of the fallout, a little bit of the afterword of this chapter. And that'll go live for you the day after Thanksgiving 2013. Have a great week. I will talk to you then. Take care. Bye. Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners and